Geekscape.com.
The Painted Savages of England, Part 2. The temple held out, but after a siege of 2 days, was taken by storm. Petilius Cerealis, who commanded the 9th Legion, marched to the relief of the place. The Britons, flushed with success, advanced to give him battle. The legion was put to the rout, and the infantry cut to pieces. Cerealis escaped with the cavalry to his entrenchments. Catus Decianus, the procurator of the province, alarmed at the scene of carnage which he beheld on every side, and further dreading the indignation of a people, whom by rapine and oppression he had driven to despair, betook himself to flight, and crossed over into Gaul. Suetonius, undismayed by this disaster, marched through the heart of the country as far as London, a place not dignified with the name of a colony, but the chief residence of merchants and the great mart of trade and commerce. At that place he meant to fix the seat of war, but reflecting on the scanty numbers of his little army, and the fatal rashness of Cerealis, he resolved to quit that station, and by giving up one post, secure for the rest of the province. Neither supplications nor the tears of the inhabitants could induce him to change his plan. The signal for the march was given. All who chose to follow his banners were taken under his protection. Of all who, on account of their advanced age, the weakness of their sex, or the attractions of the situation, thought proper to remain behind, not one escaped the rage of the barbarians. The inhabitants of Verulamium, a municipal town, were in like manner put to the sword. The genius of a savage people leads them always in quest of plunder, and accordingly the Britons left behind them all places of strength. Wherever they expected feeble resistance and considerable booty, there they were sure to attack with the fiercest rage. Military skill was not the talent of barbarians. The number massacred in the places which have been mentioned amounted to no less than 70,000, all citizens or allies of Rome. To make prisoners and reserve them for slavery, or to exchange them, was not in the idea of a people who despised all the laws of war. The halter and the gibbet, slaughter and desolation, fire and the sword were the marks of savage valour. Aware that vengeance would overtake them, they were resolved to make sure of their revenge and glut themselves with the blood of their enemies. The 14th Legion, with the veterans of the 20th and the auxiliaries from the adjacent stations, having joined Suetonius, his army amounted to little less than 10,000 men. Thus reinforced, he resolved without loss of time to bring on a decisive action. For this purpose, he chose a spot encircled with woods, narrow at the entrance and sheltered in the rear by a thick forest. In that situation, he had no fear of an ambuscade. The enemy, he knew, had no approach but in front. An open plain lay before him. He drew up his men in the following order. The legions in close array formed the centre. The light armed troops were stationed at hand to serve as occasion might require. The cavalry took post in the wings. The Britons brought into the fight an incredible multitude. They formed no regular line of battle. Detached parties and loose battalions displayed their numbers in frantic transport, bounding with exultation, and so sure of victory that they placed their wives in wagons at the extremities of the plain, where they might survey the scene of action and behold the wonders of British valour. Boudica, in a warlike car, with her 2 daughters before her, drove through the ranks. She harangued the different nations in their turn. "This," she said, "is not the first time that the Britons have been led to battle by a woman." but now she did not come to boast the pride of a long line of ancestry, not even to recover her kingdom and the plundered wealth of her family. She took the field, like the meanest among them, to assert the cause of public liberty, and to seek revenge for her body, seamed with ignominious stripes, and her two daughters infamously ravished. From the pride and arrogance of the Romans, nothing is sacred, all are subject to violation. The old endure the scourge, and the virgins are deflowered, but the vindictive gods are now at hand. A Roman legion dared to face the warlike Britons. With their lives they paid for their rashness. Those who survived the carnage of that day lie poorly hid behind their entrenchments, meditating nothing but how to save themselves by ignominious flight. From the din of preparation and the shouts of the British army, the Romans even now shrink back with terror. What will be their case when the assault begins? Look round and view your numbers. Behold the proud display of warlike spirits, and consider the motives for which we draw the avenging sword. On this spot, we must either conquer or die with glory. There is no alternative. Though a woman, my resolution is fixed. The men, if they please, may survive with infamy and live in bondage. In the final onslaught, the Romans overwhelmed Boudica, but not until they had lost 400 men. Rather than fall into the hands of her enemies, Boudica committed suicide. A noble Roman matron who committed suicide rather than surrender her virtue to the call of lust earned the praise of posterity. Shall we blame Boudica for doing likewise? To us, at this remote day, it may seem that her wild words and her ferocious deeds are far removed from those standards we seek to inculcate. But we must not overlook the insults to her womanhood and the outrage to her maternal instincts that had driven her to frenzy. Princess, if our aged eyes weep upon thy matchless wrongs, 'tis because resentment ties all the terrors of our tongues. On the theory of the painted savage, less might have been expected of her than of the Romans. When we have said the most and the worst we can against her, we are left with the solid fact that she was brave enough to pit the strength of a British queen against the might of the Roman legions. The lines of William Cowper were prophetic. Regions Caesar never knew, thy posterity shall sway, where his eagles never flew, none invincible as they. We have taken a sample of the manhood of the West and a sample of the womanhood of the East. We conclude this section with a sample of the manhood of the North. Among the chieftains, a distinguished by their birth and valour, the most renowned was Galgacus. The multitude gathered around him, eager for action and burning with uncommon ardour. He harangued them to the following effect. When I consider the motives that have roused us to this war, when I reflect on the necessity that now demands our finest vigour, I expect everything great and noble from that union of sentiment that pervades us. From this day I date the freedom of Britain. We are the men who never crouched in bondage. Beyond this spot, there is no land where liberty can find a refuge. Even the sea is shut against us, while the Roman fleet is hovering on the coast. To draw the sword in the cause of freedom is the true glory of the brave, and in our condition, cowardice itself would throw away the scabbard. In the battles which have been hitherto fought with alternate vicissitudes of fortune, our countrymen might well repose some hopes in us. They might consider us as their last resource. They knew us to be the noblest sons of Britain, placed in the last recesses of the land, in the very sanctuary of liberty. We have not so much as seen the melancholy regions where slavery has debased mankind. We have lived in freedom, and our eyes have been unpolluted by the sight of ignoble bondage. The extremity of the earth is ours, defended by our situation. We have to this day preserved our honour and the rights of men, but we are no longer safe in our obscurity. Our retreat is laid open. The enemy rushes on, and as things unknown are ever magnified, he thinks a mighty conquest lies before him. But this is the end of the habitable world, and rocks and brawling waves fill all the spaces behind. The Romans are in the heart of our country. No submission can satisfy their pride. No concessions can appease their fury. While the land has anything left, it is the theatre of war. When it can yield no more, they explore the sea for hidden treasure. Are the nations rich? Roman avarice is their enemy. Are they poor? Roman ambition lords it over them. The East and the West have been rifled, and the spoilier is still insatiate. The Romans, by a strange singularity of nature, are the only people who invade with equal ardour the wealth and the poverty of nations. To rob, to ravish, and to murder, in their imposing language, are the arts of civil policy. When they have made the world a solitude, they call it peace. Our children and relatives are dear to us all. It is an affection planted in our breast by the hand of nature, and yet those tender pledges are ravished from us to serve in distant lands. Are our wives, our sisters, and our daughters safe from brutal lust and open violation? The insidious conqueror, under the mask of hospitality and friendship, brands them with dishonour. Our money is conveyed into their treasury, and our corn into their granaries. Our limbs and bodies are worn out in clearing woods and draining marshes, and what have been our wages? Stripes and insult. The lot of the meanest slave, born in servitude, is preferable to ours. He is sold but once, and his master maintains him, but Britain every day invites new tyrants, and every day pampers their pride. In a private family, a slave who is last brought in provokes the mirth and ridicule of the whole domestic crew, and in this general servitude, to which Rome has reduced the world, the case is the same. We are treated at first as objects of derision, and then marked out for destruction. What better lot can we expect? We have no arable lands to cultivate for a master, no mines to dig for his avarice, no harbours to improve for his commerce. To what end should the conqueror spare us? Our virtue and undaunted spirit are crimes in the eyes of the conqueror, and will render us more obnoxious. Our remote situation, hitherto the retreat of freedom, and to that account the more suspected, will only serve to inflame the jealousy of our enemies. We must expect no mercy. Let us therefore dare like men. We all are surrounded by the great call of nature, not only those who know the value of liberty, but even such as think life on any terms the dearest blessing. The Trinovantes, who had only a woman to lead them on, were able to carry fire and sword through a whole colony. They stormed the camps of the enemy, and if success had not intoxicated them, they had been, beyond all doubt, the deliverers of their country. And shall not we, unconquered and undebased by slavery, a nation ever free and struggling now, not to recover, but to ensure our liberties, shall we not go forth the champions of our country? Shall we not, by one generous effort, show the Romans that we are the men whom Caledonia has reserved to be asserters of the public weal? We know the manners of the Romans, and are we to imagine that their valour in the field is equal to their arrogance in time of peace? By our dissensions their glory rises. The vices of their enemies are the negative virtues of the Roman army. If That may be called an army, which is no better than a motley crew of various nations held together by success and ready to crumble away in the first reversal of fortune. That this will be their fate, no one can doubt, unless we suppose that the Gaul, the German, and, with shame I add, the Britons, a mercenary band who hire their blood in a foreign service, will adhere from principle to a new master whom they have lately served and long detested. They are now enlisted by awe and terror. Break their fetters, and the man who forgets to fear will seek revenge. All that can inspire the human heart, every motive that can excite us to deeds of valour, is on our side. The field to animate their drooping spirit, no parents to reproach their want of courage. They are not listed in the cause of their country. Their country, if any they have, lies at a distance. They are a band of mercenaries, a wretched handful of devoted men, who tremble and look aghast as they roll their eyes around and see on every side objects unknown before. The sky over their heads, the sea, the woods, all things conspire to fill them with doubt and terror. They come like victims, delivered into our hands by the gods, to fall this day, a sacrifice to freedom. In the ensuing battle, be not deceived by false appearances. The glitter of gold and silver may dazzle the eye, but to us it is harmless, to the Romans no protection. In their own ranks, we shall find a number of generous warriors ready to assist our cause. The Britons know that for common liberties we draw the avenging sword. The Gauls will remember that they were once a free people, and the Germans, as the Usipians lately did, will desert their colours. The Romans have left nothing in their rear to oppose us in the pursuit. Their forts are ungarrisoned, the veterans in their colonies droop with age, in their municipal towns nothing but anarchy, despotic government, and disaffected subjects. In me, behold your general, behold an army of freeborn men. Your enemy is before you, and in his train, heavy tributes, drudgery in the mines, and all the horrors of slavery. Are those calamities to be entailed upon us? Or shall this day relieve us by a brave revenge? There is the field of battle. Let that determine. Let us seek the enemy, and as we rush upon him, remember the glory delivered down to us by our ancestors, and let each man think that upon his sword depends the fate of all posterity. The Caledonians were driven back, but the Romans never penetrated far into Scotland. I have given these extracts at length because isolated sentences fail to convey the real significance of the incidents. We see from the above that in Wales, England, and Scotland, the leaders were animated by the same noble sentiments. After a war of about 40 years, undertaken by the most stupid, maintained by the most dissolute, and terminated by the most timid of all the emperors, the far greater part of the island submitted to the Roman yoke, says Gibbon. But the judgment of Gibbon is not endorsed by Tacitus. Even Julius Caesar, the first of the Romans, who set his foot in Britain at the head of an army, can only be said by a prosperous battle to have struck the natives with terror and to have made himself master of the seashore. The discoverer, not the conqueror of the island, he did no more than show it to posterity. Rome could not boast of a conquest. When Britain, with the rest of the Roman world, fell to the lot of Vespasian, the ablest officers were sent to reduce the island, powerful armies were set in motion, and the spirit of the natives began to droop. In order to spread a general terror, Petilius Cerealis fell with sudden fury on the Brigantes. These extracts make it abundantly clear that the Romans did not make the mistake of underrating the prowess of the Britons. They recognized that the Britons were foes worthy of the best Roman steel. In no sense was Britain conquered, either by Caesar or his successors. At best, the Romans only occupied this land. This England never did, nor never shall, lie at the proud foot of a conqueror. But when it first did help to wound itself, come the three corners of the world in arms, and we shall shock them, nought shall make us rue, if England do itself do rest but true. I am using the term Britain as distinct from the term England, which came into use after the arrival of the English in the 5th century. In other words, I'm using the term Britain as the name of this country for the first 500 years of the Christian era. Investigations into the available records show that Christianity was firmly established in this land centuries before the arrival of Augustine the Monk, who is commonly credited with converting England. It may be safely asserted that Christianity in England took its rise from Glastonbury. What cannot be said for any other ecclesiastical city can be stated on behalf of Glastonbury, that here the earliest British Christian church remained in the hands of the Britons, while other parts were invaded and conquered by the Saxons, and while in other places the people bowed the knee to Woden, here Christ was still acknowledged, and when Glastonbury in its turn was conquered and became English, the Saxons had already joined the Christian standard, so that there was no break in the one true worship. In or about the year AD 60, St. Philip sent Joseph of Arimathea over to Britain to preach the gospel, and he, with 12 companions, came by way of Wales, from the south of France, and the British chief, Arviragus, allowed them to settle in the Isle of Innisfitrin, which was the origin of the 12 Hides of Glastonbury. The Reverend Lionel Smithet Lewis, the vicar of Glastonbury, has done a lot of valuable research in this field, and advise you to read his books. On well-reasoned grounds, he gives the death of Joseph of Arimathea at Glastonbury in AD 82. The story has been so well and so often told that it is not necessary for me to repeat it here. In the long-lost chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, we are told of the visit of St. Paul to England and of his preaching on Ludgate Hill, London. There is considerable doubt concerning the authenticity of this pamphlet, and I do not ask you to accept it as beyond question, but we do have the fact of St. Paul's Cathedral on Ludgate Hill, and we have St. Paul's Cross, traditionally marking the spot where St. Paul stood. I pass on to a valuable pamphlet by the Reverend C.C. Dobson, the vicar of St. Mary in the Castle, Hastings. There are several paragraphs which bear witness to the early planting of Christianity in Britain and to the connection of the household of Caradoc with the royal house of Rome. After referring to the personal names mentioned by St. Paul in his epistles to the Romans and the Philippians, Mr. Dobson says, "The names that need our immediate attention are Pomponia, Linus, Claudia, and Pudens." Pomponia was a sister of Caractacus, her original name being Gladys. She married Aulus Plotius, the Roman commander of the Claudian invasion of England, probably about the time of the Claudian Treaty in Britain. She now took the name of Pomponia, the name of the clan or gens to which her husband belonged. Aulus Plotius was recalled to Rome about 47, taking her with him. For 40 years, she was a leader of the best Roman society, the name Gracchina being added to her name Pomponia in recognition of her scholarship in Greek. She was accused of a foreign superstition, but the charge does not seem to have been seriously pressed, since her husband was appointed her judge, and she was naturally acquitted. Here I will add the words of Tacitus, on which the above is based. Pomponia Gracchina, a woman of illustrious birth and the wife of Plautius, who on his return from Britain entered the city with the pomp of an ovation, was accused of embracing the rites of a foreign superstition. The matter was referred to the jurisdiction of her husband. Plautius, in conformity to ancient usage, called together a number of her relations, and in her presence sat in judgment on the conduct of his wife. He pronounced her innocent. It seems to be generally agreed that the foreign superstition was Christianity. It should be noted that Tacitus describes Pomponia as of illustrious birth, and it is evident that she was a lady of culture and aristocratic manners. Mr. Dobson brings forward supporting evidence for the following statement. Linus, therefore the first bishop of Rome, ordained by St. Paul, was brother of Claudia, and therefore a British prince, and son of Caractacus, since, as we shall see, Claudia was the latter's daughter. The British form of his name was Clin. Pudens. Here again we have a Pudens, a son of Pudentius, praetor castrum, of the Roman headquarters at Regnium, under Aulus Plautius, during the Roman invasion in AD 42. His name is on the Pudens stone at Chichester as having given a site for a temple. In addition to the Pudens above referred to, there is the Pudens of 2 Timothy chapter 4 verse 21 and the Pudens mentioned by the Roman poet Martial. Mr. Dobson finds that the three are the same person and shows the difficulties in the way of assuming that they were different persons. He then concludes, if, however, they are the same, everything, including dates, fits in exactly. Pudens met Claudia in Britain in AD 43-47, during which time his commander Plautius marries her aunt Pomponia. He returns to Rome with Plautius, about 47, and in due course succeeds to his father's estates. In 52, Claudia arrives as a captive with her father, Caractacus, residing in the famous Palatium Britannicum. Pudens and Claudia renew their acquaintance. The palace of Plautius, the old commander of Pudens, and Pomponia, the aunt of Claudia, doubtless provides the place of meeting. The marriage takes place in about 53. This Claudia, daughter of Caractacus, captured in his final reverse, sharing his captivity in Rome. Her Welsh name was Gladys, and her aunt Pomponia bore the same name, which was the Welsh for princess. She took the name of Claudia when the Emperor Claudius adopted her as his daughter. Martial extols her beauty, wit, and fascination. He speaks of her as uniting the accomplishments of Rome and Athens. Claudia, of the clan of Rufus, belongs to the blue-eyed Britons. How popular she is, how she holds the hearts of the Latin folk, how beautiful of figure. Italian matrons might think she was of their own race. Thus we see that Caradoc and his family were esteemed as worthy of the highest places. Character, culture, grace, charm, and religion are all manifest in these illustrious people. If they were painted savages, they were savages of a unique kind. They were counted worthy to share the palaces of the highest in the land. The Christian faith they had embraced in their own land emboldened them to be witnesses in the land and city of their captivity. The preceding paragraphs have shown us that the Christian faith flourished in England a short time after the death of our Lord, that is, in the first century AD. We have ample evidence to show that it flourished in the second century also. The Venerable Bede informs us that in the year of our Lord's incarnation, 156, Marcus Antonius Verus, the 14th from Augustus, was made emperor, together with his brother Aurelius Commodus. In their time, whilst Eleutherius, a holy man, presided over the Roman Church, Lucius, king of the Britons, sent a letter to him, entreating that by his command he might be made a Christian. He soon obtained his pious request, and the Britons preserved the faith which they had received, uncorrupted and entire, in peace and tranquillity, until the time of the Emperor Diocletian. Similar information is given in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. AD 167. This year Eleutherius obtained the bishopric of Rome and held it in great glory for 12 years. To him, Lucius, king of Britain, sent letters praying that he might be made a Christian, and he fulfilled that he requested, and they afterwards continued in the right faith till the reign of Diocletian. Shortly after this date, we find the Church of St. Peter's, Cornhill, London, in existence. The present building is, of course, of a much later date. Over the chimney piece of the vestry room is a tablet preserved from the Great Fire, bearing the following inscription. Be it be known to all men that the year of our Lord 179, Lucius, the first Christian king of the land, then called Britain, founded the first church in London, that is to say, the Church of St. Peter upon Cornhill, and he founded there an archbishop's see, and made the church the metropolitan and chief church of this kingdom, and so endured the space of 400 years, until the coming of St. Austin, the apostle of England, the which was sent into the land of St. Gregory, the doctor of the church, in the time of King Ethelbert, and then was the archbishop's see and pall removed from the aforesaid church of St. Peter's upon Cornhill into Dorobernia, that is now called Canterbury, and there it remaineth to this day. And Millet, a monk which came into this land with St. Austin, he was made the first bishop of London, and his see was made in St. Paul's Church, and this Lucius, king, was the first founder of St. Peter's Church upon Cornhill, and he reigned in this land after Brutus 1,245 years, and in the year of our Lord God 124, Lucius was crowned king, and the years of his reign were 77 years, and he was buried after some chronicles at London, and after some chronicles he was buried at Gloucester, where the order of St. Francis standeth now. We have melancholy evidence that the British people continued in the faith. Some of them witnessed unto the death and sealed their testimony with their lifeblood. St. Alban is generally recognized as the first English martyr. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle gives 286 AD as the date of his death. In more recent times, authorities have given 304. Whatever uncertainty there may be about the date, there is no uncertainty about the fact. St. Alban's Cathedral commemorates this noble British martyr. If England were enveloped in heathen darkness, as many writers would have us suppose, we have the singular fact of a man dying for a faith that did not exist. In the Sunday Observer of October the 7th, 1934, there is an article on Links with London's Past, over the initials GG. In it, the writer asks, how many Londoners know that there was a St. Pancras, or that he was a Roman convert who died at the hands of Diocletian? In 303 AD, Diocletian, Emperor of Rome, issued his decree against the Christians, which led to that bitter persecution, which must forever stain his name. Again we ask, how came it to pass that a Christian in this land suffered martyrdom for the faith, if the land was enveloped in heathen darkness? The martyrdom of St. Alban and St. Pancras proves not only that the Christian faith flourished in this land at the time, but also that it had become so strongly rooted that men thought death by torture preferable to disloyalty to their Lord. The 4th century was a flowering period in the history of the British Church. It was so well developed, so well organized, that it could send bishops to the general councils of the Church. Even the Anglo-Catholics, who had derived the church in England from the Roman See, are compelled to admit this. The church in Britain, from the beginning, was recognized throughout Christendom as a true and integral part of the universal Church of Christ, the ancient British bishops having been consecrated by other bishops who were in a direct line from the apostles. The first council at which British bishops were present was held at Arles in Gaul, AD 314. The Council of Arles was called by order of Constantine, the Roman Emperor. Its records show that 33 bishops were present, of whom 3 came from Britain, i.e. Eborius, Bishop of York, Restitutus, Bishop of London, and Adelphius, Bishop de Civitate Colonnae Londinensium. Professor Fisher identifies the last with Lincoln. St. Athanasius, the leading debater on the Orthodox side at Nicaea, tells us that a deputation of bishops from Britain attended the Council of Sardesia and defended him against the accusations of the Arian party, a fact which speaks well for the strength and vitality of the British Church. The Council at Ariminum, AD 360, was summoned by Constantius, the son of Constantine, and several bishops from Britain were present, 3 allowing their expenses to be paid by Constantius out of the imperial treasury. Hilary of Poitiers congratulated the bishops of the province of Britain, among other bishops, on having remained free from all the contagion of the detestable Arian heresy, while St. Athanasius reckoned the Britons among those who were loyal to the Catholic faith in his letter to the Emperor Jovian in AD 363. A few years later, St. Jeremy affirmed that Britain worships the same Christ, observes the same rule of faith with the other Christian countries. Such was the land of heathen darkness before the coming of the Roman monk. Such were the painted savages of England before Augustine, in AD 597, brought to them the light of the glorious gospel of the blessed God. For 1,000 years before Augustine set foot on our shores, the people of this land had been blessed with the light of learning, and illustrious men and women had proved themselves peers of the Romans, their miscalled conquerors. No people has ever been so shamefully libelled. No people has ever been so caricatured by subsequent writers. Shakespeare, with his mighty genius, stands out as the one great writer who has done anything like justice to the land and its people.
You're listening to Radio Arian at RadioArian.com.